And now I have the honor of introducing our congressional keynote speaker, Senator Amy Klobuchar, who represents the state of Minnesota in the United States Senate. I have a certain fondness for Minnesota because I got my PhD at the University of Minnesota. Since arriving in the Senate, she's worked across the aisle on legislation focused on moving the country forward. As a member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Senator Klobuchar was part of the important Farm Bill Conference Committee that reached an agreement between the Senate and the House on a long-term farm bill in 2014. In January, Biofuels Digest recognized her as one of only three U.S. senators to make the top list of top 125 people in the advanced bioeconomy for 2015. So please join me in welcoming the senator.
Thank you so much, Undersecretary Orr, and thank you, everyone, for being here. I never knew about that. I was one of those top three senators. Of course, what do you think I'm thinking? Who are the other two? So I don't know who they are. But it is great to be here, and especially great to be introduced by someone who got his education at the University of Minnesota. And so we know that we taught you everything that you knew, or, well, most of it. So thank you. I know there's a lot of great Minnesota companies and friends from Minnesota here. Thank you for that. I do bring you greetings from our state, where in the words of our poet laureate, Garrison Keillor, the women are strong, right? The men are good looking. Just meet a guy from Minnesota. You'll see that's true. And all the bioenergy professionals are above average. So thank you for being here. Minnesota, as you've probably heard, has taken an incredibly proactive approach to energy use and sustainability. And what's interesting about our state, and you've probably seen this across the country, and with what we want to bring back to the United States Congress, this was always a bipartisan effort in Minnesota from the beginning. In fact, it all started up when Governor Pawlenty, who later ran for president, was the governor of our state, Republican governor. We had a mixed legislature, and the decision was made to move forward with a renewable fuel standard, a very strong one, and at the same time to move forward with a renewable electricity standard. And those were different constituencies, and they had different results. But the point of it was they saw this way to blend in the work for the people that wanted wind and solar and wanted to do more on the RES side with the farmers and the people that wanted to do more on the renewable fuel side with the E85. And so that all happened at around the same time, and it was a way of building a coalition to actually get a strong standard done. On the renewable electricity side, our standard was at the time one of the most aggressive in the country, 25% by 2025, 30% for Xcel, our biggest energy company. We were the first state in the nation to require gasoline to be blended with 10% ethanol, and we're a national leader in the use of E85. And across the state, drivers who want to fill up with E85 have 280, but who's counting, fueling stations to choose from, and 78 of those now feature blender pumps. And as you know, there's been some effort by some major companies to increase the number of blender pumps, so that's more and more of a choice. So that's what's happening on our state side. We're making progress on advanced biofuels. We're home to a lot of institutes and companies that want to move forward. Places like Great Plains Institute, which is working with more than 300 partners from industry, academia, government, and nonprofits to fundamentally change how our nation uses energy. So I get to Washington. I think when it comes to energy policy on the federal level, you all know we have some work to do. I'm sure you've been talking about it at the conference. This hasn't been the easiest time to be in Washington, especially someone for myself that came from a nonpartisan background. I was the chief prosecutor for 8 years in Hennepin County. I did civil work as well. We actually did a lot of energy work there because we did some innovative things. But the point was it didn't even have a partisan identification on the ballot. And the next thing I know, I'm in Washington where people don't even sit on the same, they don't even mix when they sit at committee rooms or have lunch together. So this was a major change for me. It kind of feels like kindergarten sometimes with the girls on one side and the boys on other. I thought I had actually reached my lowest moment the night of the fiscal cliff vote, if you all remember that. We went till something like 1 or 2 in the morning, and there I was. This was on New Year's Eve. All the taxes were going up. We had to find some sensible way to help with the budget, but also not let everyone's taxes go up. And it went on and on and on. And finally, at midnight on New Year's Eve, you know, that magical moment, I'm standing on the Senate floor, true story. I look to my left, I see Harry Reid. I look to my right, I see Mitch McConnell. Every girl's dream on New Year's Eve. That was my New Year's Eve. And I thought, okay, we can't go much further than this. But no, then, of course, we had, we got to the point of the shutdown, where we literally lost billions of dollars in the economy. I had a jet manufacturer, small jet manufacturer, Cirrus, up in northern Minnesota, where the employment can be kind of difficult. They had all these jets sitting in a warehouse because they have a huge export market. FAA had to furlough the people that do the approvals, and they waited and waited and waited to get those out. That's just one example. There are examples all over in every state, every nation, and it wasn't just national parks. Well, out of that, again, rose some sensibility. Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, a good friend of mine, stood up, gave a speech. I was the first Democrat that joined her. We formed a group of 14 people, half Democrats, half Republicans, half women. And we ended up coming up with an idea. We brought it to both leaders. We said, if you don't come up with an idea just like this, in 3 hours we have the press galleries reserved. And they ended up in then 2 hours coming out with that deal, which I think everyone at the time said, well, why is this such a short time frame? Well, we know the public was pissed. They were so pissed. So we thought, why don't we seize on this moment so that then we can actually get rid of part of sequestration. That's when we got rid of half of sequestration. Patty Murray and Congressman Ryan negotiated a budget deal, and then we went on to get appropriations. So out of that badness came some good. And so now I'm going to start telling you the badness from my perspective in this policy and our energy policy, and then give you some optimism about where we can go from here. Of course, we look back in history, first bad moment in terms of us losing an opportunity was right after 9/11. We all remember the country was united. President Bush, as you remember, stood up there and he could have said, okay, we're going to have a new energy policy. We don't want to be dependent on these people that have been buying oil from these people that we can't trust, people that have been harboring terrorists. We don't want to do that anymore. We could have thought of many ways to do it, but I think people would have been willing to actually pay money for this policy. I think 80% of Americans would have said, sign me up. And instead, at that moment, he suggested people go shopping, if you remember that. So we lost that opportunity. The second opportunity I put on Congress, that was during the summer of 2008. Was right before the downturn, so in a strange way, it was a time where we could have actually done more in policy. We were able at the time to get those energy efficiency standards through, which was actually a good thing, which I called at the time the bridge to the next century. No, that's not right. I called it the fridge to the next century. Okay, just an energy joke at 8 in the morning. Okay, so we got that done, but we didn't do the next big step, which was the renewable electricity standard, sort of taking on from the one we have in Minnesota and that you see in other states and regions across the country. We were one vote short of beating the filibuster, one vote short. We were at 59 votes or, you know, something in that neighborhood. And so we lost that opportunity to do something more major in Congress. I remember where I was standing. It was like midnight again, 1 a.m. I remember Maria Cantwell was working with me to try to get it done, and we didn't make it. So that was a lost opportunity for sure, because then we get to the third lost opportunity, which was President Obama comes in. We're in the middle of the worst downturn, you know, since the Great Depression. We're losing more jobs in 1 month than we had people in the state of Vermont in that first January when he was there. Really difficult time to do energy policy. But I still look back at it, and I remember talking to the administration about this and talking to the president about this at the time, that we should move forward with a renewable electricity standard of some kind, because we actually knew that we had the votes, because we had had 59 votes, you know, just that summer before. The decision was made not to do that, but to go with cap and trade. Now, I supported it out of the committee, so I can say this with some immunity, but it wasn't the right time to do that. It didn't work. Everyone thought that name, cap and trade, was so cute because John McCain had supported it on the presidential campaign because he had supported it before. But in fact, when you think about it, that name, it's really not a really good brand, okay? I would be in the parades in northern Minnesota, and people would yell, no on trade, no on caps. Okay, like they didn't know what it was. They thought it was trade and cap. It didn't. It was not really well thought out. It may have been well thought out policy-wise, but in terms of the politics at that very moment when we were bleeding jobs and we needed some kind of policy, I would have still gone with the renewable electricity standard first and then move on to see what we could get from there. Okay, so that's all the lost opportunities. And when I look at this point in our country, I think for the last, decade or so, we've been governing from crisis. We've been governing from crisis, one crisis after another. You go way back to 9/11 as a crisis. Then you go into, of course, the downturn. And it just hasn't. Other bills that are so important to work on, like immigration reform, like our energy policy, like changes to our education policy, have just been kind of sitting there as we dealt with things like Dodd-Frank bill, and we dealt with things like the TARP bill and the stimulus bill, which, of course, as you know, had some good energy things in it in the stimulus bill. But now is this moment to govern from opportunity. So that's where I see this new hope and where we're headed. We have this moment in time. And as Energy Secretary Moniz said earlier this month at the Energy Information Administration Conference, sustained longer-term investments and policy decisions are paying major dividends to consumers, the environment, and our economy, and the nation's energy security. This has greatly enhanced our position, but we are still left with challenges. Or, in the word of the Pope last week, please tell the Energy Secretary that I quoted him before the Pope. Okay, thank you. But in the words of the Pope last week, and I like to always quote the Pope, this is good, what kind of world do we want to leave to those who come after us, to children who are now growing up? Well, I'd argue that the world that we want to leave our children should be less dependent on the energy of the past and fueled with clean energy from the sun, from the wind, and from biomass. And while we've made steps toward leading the world in clean energy, we're not as far as we should be, or as far as my own state of Minnesota has come. So when you look at these two quotes and what they're talking about, I really think there's two nuggets here. One is the Pope taking this on, and he's coming to Congress. That's going to be really good. But the Pope is coming to Congress, and that kind of moral leadership that we're seeing across the world, that we're actually seeing in other faith communities, from the evangelical community to the Jewish community. We have seen this before when we were trying to get the climate change bill done, but we've seen that before. So I just think there's this renewed belief. The second change, which gives me optimism, is just as people are starting to see they can get the money for it, right? All those studies that show, well, people will stop using as much air conditioning or as much heat. They'll turn down their thermometer a bit if they see how their neighbors are doing and how much money they can save. Or people that are driving more fuel-efficient cars because they see in the long term they can save money. So there's just a different approach as people are starting to, it's starting to get through. And we're also out of that downturn, so they're less susceptible to bad facts and arguments that don't work. One of my favorite debunking of bad facts was the John Oliver show. I don't know when I saw it. My daughter actually showed it to me. It was a few months back. And he was showing how people that claim that climate change doesn't even exist, scientists are so outnumbered. So what he decided to do, he brought like one or two scientists in these little white coats on that said that they believe climate change didn't exist, and they talked to him. And then he brought 97 other people out in white coats to show the difference between people that believed in science and thought things was happening and people that weren't. So I think you're starting to see this resurgence with young people and interest in this issue, and this all plays into positivity where we can go forward. So where are you seeing this optimism? Well, first of all, the states. I've talked enough about Minnesota. North Carolina's solar industry has taken off under the state's 2007 Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Standard that requires utilities to use renewable sources for 6% of power by this year and 12.5% by 2020. And Mississippi, that's right, has adopted the most up-to-date International Energy Conservation Code for commercial buildings, putting that state on league with Washington, Oregon, and Massachusetts in taking proactive steps in saving energy. So that's what's been happening. Just example, two states that you wouldn't think anything would be happening and where things are happening. So on the national level, other reasons for optimism. The Farm Bill includes some major victories for renewable energy. I work closely with my colleagues to lead the effort to fully fund the energy title, and we were able to maintain the entire $880 million that was in the Senate version, including my amendment for an additional $100 million for energy programs, an amendment that I put on with Senator Hoeven in the committee, and that made it through to the end. In the end, we got a good bill done, and it has some strong energy provisions, and that was bipartisan, passed both houses. Second reason for hope, and again, these are not major victories, but the way I look at this, part of what we do is defend some of the rules we have in place, work with the agencies to get things done and make our case so that we can get biomass out there as established and more established energy form, make our case with the facts and the economics of this, and then the last thing is to get some bipartisan victories in Congress, and they are not the big victories you want right now. But if we were just to throw up our hands and say, oh, you know, those guys suck and we can't get anything done, then we're not at all paving the way for that one moment when we maybe can get something done, when there is this comprehensive energy bill. So the example I would use is the portion of the Shaheen-Portman energy bill that passed this year. It contains a range of policies that would reduce residential, commercial, and industrial energy use. Senator Hovind, my Republican buddy from North Dakota, and I had a provision in there for hot water heaters. You really don't want to hear about it. But they were going to be stop making major, big hot water heaters that all our rural electric co-ops use. The environmental community was actually on our side, as were all the electric co-ops. We were threatening Shaheen and Portman that we were going to pull out our hot water heater provision if they didn't get it done that night because we were approaching a deadline. And it worked because no one wanted to have us pull out our little hot water heater provision that everyone liked in the Senate. We were able to keep the bill together and get it passed. You think all we do is things at 3 in the morning at 3 in the morning. But that was what happened with the Shaheen-Portman bill. Other reasons for hope. We had leading the pack when you look at agencies and what's happening is the Department of Defense, which uses more energy over the course of its daily operations than any other private or public organization. It's the world's largest consumer of energy. Did you guys know that? I didn't know it, so that was new. A recent partnership between the USDA and the DOD, a program called Farm to Fleet, seeks to make biofuel blends part of the regular operational fuel purchased and used by the military. The important program has opened the DOT procurement process to drop in biofuels and lowered the barriers for alternative domestic fuel suppliers to do business with the DOD. The first deliveries, expected later this year, will power both our national security interests and our rural communities. And we're seeing a push to expand the bioenergy sector to solve problems on a global scale, including energy poverty, environmental degradation, and economic development. The UN Secretary launched the Sustainable Energy for All initiative with the goal of doubling the global use of renewable energy by 2030. So you see, you start with the states, they're doing more and more, even red states like Mississippi. You look at what's happening with our own government agencies. You look at what's happening with the rest of the world. So how do we build on this progress? Well, I think the first thing is to make sure that we don't tear apart some of the good policies that we have in place, and we do that with facts, with those 97 guys in those white coats. As you all know, we've had a major battle in the last year and a half over the renewable fuel standard. I felt really strongly about that. I actually traveled our state and did meetings with farmers. I felt like I was, you know, back in one of those Freedom to Farm rallies where all the farmers were angry way back before I was even in politics, and they would show up and they were so mad that our own government, our own administration would think about peeling that back at a time when the oil companies were doing incredibly well and at a time where we've made so much progress in reducing our dependency on foreign oil from something like 60-some percent to 40-some percent with a mixture of things, higher, better fuel standards for cars, better domestic drilling and natural gas, and then, of course, biofuels. And there were so many meetings where I'd have to stand up and say, hey, you forgot to mention the biofuels. This is no longer a boutique fuel. This was, at the time, 10% of our fuel supply. So we pushed back on the proposed RFS. As you know, the EPA finally released its long-delayed rule, setting the volumes through 2017. And although it did reflect a slight improvement, especially when it came to biodiesel, it still falls well short of the goal of the RFS. It proposes for the first time to decrease the amount of renewable fuel being consumed in the country, and it has, as you know, created uncertainty in the industry. So more has to be done on that. We're going to continue to push for change. We have been successful every single year in pushing back those that want to eliminate the RFS altogether. We've been successful in going after some of their arguments that it somehow drives up food costs and ruins the engines in our vehicles. I happen to be the state that produces snowmobiles and RTVs. I have the two biggest domestic manufacturers of snowmobiles and ATVs, Polaris and Arctic-Cat. So I am quite aware of these issues and believe that we can have a strong renewable fuel standard and still keep my strong industries in ATVs and in snowmobiles. So the things that most affect them is snowmobiles is when we don't have enough snow. So in any case, I am very hopeful that we can continue to at least keep this standard in place, as weakened as it is, against these nattering nabobs of negativism and these people that are adding these ideas every day that aren't correct. I think we have enough bipartisan support. We've got a bunch of senators up, Republican senators from Rust Belt states. Rust Belt states means that they usually have ethanol or biodiesel. I think that's in our favor. They've been pretty good on these issues, and we just haven't seen the major onslaught so far. In terms of what proposals are out there, we just haven't seen it in the mainstream rhetoric. And, of course, it's a presidential year. And, of course, the first caucus is in Iowa. And so that also helps us. So those are some of the reasons that I believe that we're going to at least keep this standard in place. I think we're seeing just a changing culture right now with young people, with what we're going to see and hear from the Pope as the months go on. Things are changing, and you are on the cusp of that change. You've been sitting out there in the trenches, starting these businesses, whether it's with algae, whether it's with corn, whether it is with any kind of these incredible things we're seeing all over the country. But you've time and time again been able to walk into this red light, green light form of energy policy where you don't know if the tax incentive is going to be in place the next year. And I'm hoping we can change that. I personally am friends of Lisa Murkowski and Maria Cantwell, who are leading the Senate Energy Committee. I think they know a lot about different forms of energy and how we could potentially get some kind of a comprehensive deal to get some good incentives in place that aren't just one-year incentives, that are much longer than that. And I see this as part of our national blueprint going forward, part of this simple idea that we want to be a country that makes stuff again, that invents things, that exports to the world. And the entire country has seen the success we've had in the last few years by using that simple philosophy that we love our financial industry, but we just can't be a country that churns money around. We have to be a country that actually makes things again. And energy is a major part of that solution. So I'll just end with this. I come from, my dad comes from the Iron Range in Minnesota. That's where my roots are. It's up near the Canadian border, as we like to say. We can see Canada from our porch. And this is kind of a hard scrabble part of our country, and it's the part that for decades and decades and centuries made the iron ore that made the cars, made the iron ore that made the helped us win that World War II. And so my grandpa, who's a kid of Slovenian immigrants, came into that as the oldest boy of 10 kids. His parents died when he was in his late teens and 20. He was left as the oldest boy to raise this family of 9 kids. He had, at age 15, quit school to go to work, even though he was getting A's, even though he wanted to go into the Navy and envision this life at sea. And instead, he went to work in the mines. And he kept that family together. The youngest girl had to go to an orphanage when she was 8 years old. And a year and a half later, he borrowed a car and went and picked her up and brought her back. And every single day, he went down in this underground mine, 1,500 feet in this cage. And I often think of what he thought about every day when he went to work. If he thought about that walk in the woods, he loved to hunt. He loved to pick blueberries and make jam. But that's what he did with his life for his family. And I think that is the kind of thing we've seen in our country. And I literally stand before you today as the granddaughter of an iron ore miner and the daughter of a newspaper man and a teacher and the first woman elected to the United States Senate from the state of Minnesota. So that is why I believe that anything and everything is possible. And the cool thing about my grandpa is he always, maybe he was like an early example of this kind of this kind of tension between industry and the environment. He had this job that involved iron ore and steel, and yet he loved the outdoors. And he didn't see them as two separate things. He saw them as things that could work together. And that's what a lot of your mission is, to take, get the energy that we need to put people like my grandpa to work, but at the same time understanding we have to do it in ways that protect our environment and further our environment. And that's why what you're doing is so cool. So don't forget it. And as my grandpa did every day, no matter what some of those people do over there at midnight on New Year's Eve, put your helmets on, right? Square your shoulders and put on your boots like he did and get, well, Barbara Mikulski always says, and get ready for the revolution. I don't know what that means. So get ready and go to work. And I promise you, what I see are these little things of hope, and I'm good at identifying them. There's change on the way, and I think it's good, and you're there on the front end. So thank you for what you're doing.